The Exchange Podcast is brought to you in part by your university system, including Granite State College, Keene State College, Plymouth State University, and the University of New Hampshire. Imagine what you can accomplish here.
The Exchange Podcast also gets support from the New Hampshire Chiropractic Association, an organization of professionals providing a non-invasive, non-surgical approach to healthcare, tailoring treatment plans to meet individuals' needs. Learn more at nhchiropractic.org.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Many Granite Staters appreciate birds, their songs, their colors, the way they migrate and enhance our landscapes. But our guests today say birds also serve as critical messengers. Just like the legendary canary in the coal mine, they warn us of environmental threats and remind us that a healthier bird population means a healthier planet. Now, a recent report updates the status of New Hampshire's birds. It's not all bad news, and we'll hear those success stories, but there is a lot to be concerned about. So we'll ask about simple steps anyone can take to bolster bird populations. Exchange listeners, let's hear from you. What have you noticed about birds near you? And what questions do you have about the threats that our birds face? Our email is exchange@nhpr.org, and our phone number is 800-892-6477. Our guests are Pam Hunt. She's an avian conservation biologist with New Hampshire Audubon. Pam, welcome back. It's great to have you.
Same here. Thanks for having me.
And also with us, Matt Tarr. He's an extension professor and wildlife specialist at UNH Cooperative Extension. And Matt, thanks for being with us.
This is great. Thanks for having me.
So, Pam, make the big sort of meta connection for us between bird health and the health of our planet, including we humans.
Oh, great. That's this nice, simple question to start off with. Yeah, you know, birds do lots of important things in ecosystems. So it's like every species does in an ecosystem. Some of them pollinate plants. Not too many do that. A lot of them eat insect pests. A lot of them disperse seeds. A lot of them are more sensitive than we are to environmental toxins. People think about DDT, for example, way back in the 70s. So, you know, they do what we call ecosystem services. That's the pollination, seed dispersal. You know, some of them eat rodents on farms. That used to be a big thing. So there's all sorts of stuff birds do on the sort of nuts and bolts of stuff. And then, of course, as you mentioned at the intro, birds are just kind of part of our experience, right? And we think about them more than we think about insects, obviously.
Yeah. Most of us see insects as pests and we love the birds. And we'll talk about the connection later. But what about birds, Pam, as, you know, messengers telling us that things are going on in our environment that we might not be aware of, but birds are sensitive and, you know, they tell us.
Yeah. One of the classic examples I often give when, you know, answering that kind of question is that, you know, we're seeing declines in lots of birds. We'll obviously get into that more as we go on here. But when we see species that are actually quite common that people are very familiar with, like chimney swifts or barn swallows, which, you know, actually live in our barns and in our chimneys, you know, they actually co-occur with us. And that they are declining at really rapid rates, like more than 50% of those species are gone in the last 50 years in New Hampshire. And we have no idea why. You know, is it insect populations, in which case is it something to do with pesticides, or is it something to do with, you know, actual poisons to the birds themselves? We honestly don't know. So these are sort of big unanswered questions about common species that are declining without knowing why. It's like there's a red flag, right? So if we can't figure out why things like that are declining, are we next? You know, if, you know, these early warning systems essentially are in bad shape, something worth looking into.
So birds operating as an early warning system, as you said, Pam, and how is climate change affecting birds? I'm guessing there are many ways, but just give us the sort of broad overview there, please.
Basically, climate change screws up everything, right? So it's going to change potentially food supplies because of changes to ocean temperatures, for one example. It can change, you know, survival during migration because of increased storms or heavy spring rains. It can change habitats by having different species present or habitats drying out. And of course, there's really big things like sea level rise is going to wipe out coastal habitat. So lots of different factors there.
Well, and Matt, let's bring you in since we're talking about habitats, because I know that's your specialty. So how have you seen climate change affecting your work with bird habitats?
That's a great question. Some of it's still largely unknown. You know, there's regular patterns that we might expect that birds are following. So again, right now is it's a fun time of the year to be a birder, because many of our migrant birds are returning back, you know, oftentimes either from the southern states or from the Caribbean. And they're coming here to New Hampshire to make their nest and to raise their young. And one of the primary reasons that all of these birds come back into the Northeast is because we have an abundance of insects, and particularly caterpillars for many of our songbirds are critical food that the birds use for raising their young. But when those caterpillars emerge is very closely tied into, you know, when plants, when plant leaves and plant buds emerge. And that's related to weather. And over time, you know, the birds have adapted to migrate, you know, back to this region at a very particular time when the plants have, you know, historically leafed out and caterpillars have become available. But what we're beginning to see is that in these early springs, sometimes those caterpillars come out and they're gone by the time that the birds come back. So that's probably one of the most obvious things that we can begin to see right now. But there's a lot that's just unknown. It's such a complex issue.
Oh, that's interesting, Matt. So everything is on kind of a synchronized clock. You know, the buds will come out around this time. The insects that follow will come out around this time. If that all happens early, the birds get here and there's nothing to eat.
Yeah, it's a challenge. So that may change from year to year. And that's just kind of part of the uncertainty about it. But that's something that I think that is probably one of the most obvious effects of climate change that we can begin to perhaps notice.
Well, before we get into really some detail about the threats our birds face in this latest Audubon report, Pam, let's just step back for a second. How does this report define our birds or New Hampshire's birds? Because it does recognize that, you know, many of them don't live here permanently. So who are we talking about here, Pam?
The report, which is, by the way, for folks in listening, called The State of New Hampshire's Birds. We just put it out in March. There are two broad categories of birds that we talk about in the report. The core of it is 193 species, which have been known to breed in the state in the last 25 years or so. Some of them quite rarely, but 180 of those or so are actually pretty reliable breeders. So that's the core of what we talk about, because we have generally really good data on population trends for those species in New Hampshire or regionally. But then there's another 80 to 100 species that occur here that don't breed here, occur here regularly, you know, either as wintering birds or birds that migrate back and through. And in this particular version of the report, we've actually added data in for those as well. So we're trying to cover both our breeders and our non-breeders this time around.
So just overall, Pam, how are they doing? I know the report has some categories of, you know, some are doing pretty well, some are stable, and some are declining.
Right. And on the broadest possible looking at this, if you look at like all the breeding species, we'll just focus on those for now. It's about half of them are increasing or stable, which is good.
Okay,
and
that is good.
Half of them are declining, which is not good. And so you might think that's probably about what you'd expect on average, which is reasonable. But the big take-home message is that the species that are declining way more rapidly than the species that are increasing. So there's probably been a net loss of individual birds over the last 50 years or so.
Well, and I think I remember, and it might have even been with you, Pam, a couple years ago, we did a whole show on that sort of blockbuster report, right? Like 3 billion birds worldwide. So how does this latest New Hampshire Audubon report kind of fit in with that broader research?
It's essentially a step down, you know, because I was working on it when that bigger report, the 3 billion birds report, came out.
Right.
And uses many of the same data sources, just very specific to New Hampshire. So, you know, a lot of the issues brought up in that report are repeated and sort of fine-tuned for New Hampshire.
Well, I want to remind listeners that we're getting an update on the health of New Hampshire's bird populations today. And we want to hear from you. What have you noticed about the birds in your area? What have you done to try to help the birds enhance bird habitat? And if you just have questions or comments about this report and what it finds about certain species of birds here in New Hampshire, as Pam told us, it's not all bad news. Join us with an email to exchange at nhpr.org. Once again, exchange at nhpr.org or a phone call 800-892-6477. And I also do want to let everybody know, in addition to talking about the health of the birds a little bit later, we are going to talk about just easy, simple steps that basically anybody can do if they're concerned about birds to enhance bird populations. One more time, our number is 800-892-6477. So here's an email from Karen. This is a good question. Karen says, how much do invasive species of birds affect indigenous birds? Last year and this year, I've seen an influx of European starlings that displace the less aggressive species I'd normally see. Karen says, is this a local phenomenon or is it happening around the state? And Pam, I'll throw that to you. I was just reading about starlings this morning, as a matter of fact. And Karen's right. They're European birds. They're not native. Go ahead, Pam.
Yeah, there's two or three species of non-native birds in New Hampshire that actually can be major pests like that. Starlings are one of them. Starlings historically probably were competing with a lot of cavity nesting birds like woodpeckers and bluebirds for nest holes and excluding them. And you know, there were declines in bluebirds probably as a result of that. They're also maybe a little aggressive at feeders. That's less of a direct problem. Starlings seem to be less of a big issue these days. Their populations in New Hampshire are actually declining somewhat, which is interesting. The other one is the house sparrow, which are the cheerful little sparrows you might find in a bush at a strip mall or a Burger King or downtown Concord. also not native, but they're, you know, often one of people's first birds. But they also will do the same thing. They're aggressive and will take over nest boxes and things like that. And they're actually a major threat to a couple of species in parts of the state, like purple martins on the seacoast, where they nest in the same purple martin houses and can actually kill the young.
Well, the report says over half of insectivores, I want to look at some of the different categories, and insectivores, you know, those birds who eat insects, are in strong decline. So let's talk about those birds. And Matt, what choices are people making at the individual backyard level that might be contributing to this insect decline?
Sure. So so much of what you know, birds and insects are responding to are the plants. And so what we find is that plant diversity tends to influence insect diversity and abundance. And so perhaps the best choices that people can make is if they are landscaping, they can choose native plants over non-native plants. There's pretty great research that shows that many of the non-native plants often support a lower abundance of particular insects that are especially important for many different types of birds than the native plants do. And particularly a lot, if we look across many of our like suburban neighborhoods, especially many of those neighborhoods they're often landscaped with the same sorts of plants. You know, forsythia is beautiful and lilacs are beautiful. But when you look at the entire neighborhood, those are like the primary plants that are there. And so there's not a lot of diversity. And so if you're working with, if you're adding plants or thinking about things to do in your land, if you can, you know, add different plants and particularly add a variety of native plants to increase the diversity of plants, particularly plants that ideally flower in the early spring, summer, and then later in the fall, that is a great way to increase food resources and pollen for insects. And then as a result, that increases the insect abundance and diversity that benefits, we would expect, many of the birds as well.
Do you have a couple favorites that you'd like to recommend, Matt? I'm struck by what you say. You know, rhododendron, azalea, lilacs are lovely, but move beyond that, yeah. You know, add some more diversity to the mix. Do you have any in particular that, you know, grow well here in New Hampshire and that insects and birds love?
Sure. Well, right now, some of the more valuable ones include things like we often think about as weeds, which are dandelions. You know, if you right now, I think I saw my first bumblebee last week, and it was, you know, foraging on, you know, on dandelions and some ground mints that are often considered to be weeds in people's lawns. You know, so simply allowing some of those weeds to grow, you know, without killing them is a fantastic and super, super easy way, you know, to enhance plant diversity to benefit insects and other wildlife. So when we're adding plants, each plant has its, you know, grows in particular environments. Some grow in wet situations like winterberry holly and some of the dogwoods. Other plants would be many of our native viburnums. Willows and birches in particular are plants that tend to support a huge variety of insects and even oak trees. And so when we're thinking about plants, we should be thinking about, you know, the low growing herbaceous stuff, even grasses, the shrubs, and even the trees. And so what we try to do is encourage a diversity of plants in each of those different layers. And that's a great way to benefit wildlife.
So Leslie writes us, please address what home gardeners can do to support birds. And we're kind of going there anyway. So how about you, Pam, jump in on this conversation about what people just, you know, in their own little yard can do to support birds.
Yeah, well, you know, thinking back to the original point about the insect-eating species, you know, we do suspect that some of these new pesticides that are out there in the world, especially these things called neonicotinoids, which are now like the dominant pesticide, and often on seed treatments even, that those are, A, you know, impacting insect populations, which is their intent, but that there's also potentially sublethal or lethal effects on birds that eat those seeds that are coated with things. So if you've got a garden or planting a vegetable garden, you know, it may be hard to find seeds that don't have those treatments. Or if you're spraying, you know, don't spray. You know, there's, you know, that's a, you know, in addition to what you plant, it's what you do with what you've got that may make a big difference in that regard.
So don't use any kind of pesticide, Pam? Nothing?
Well, I'm not an expert in pesticides, so I can't, you know, but, you know, minimize it, I guess, is, you know, the rule for most things is use in moderation. And, you know, there are ways, and the extension folks probably are way more versed in this than I am, maybe not Matt necessarily, but, you know, biological control or just the kinds of plants you put out and how they're spread around is, which, you know, I have no clue on how that works, but there are ways of minimizing how much, you know, artificial chemicals you spray on your yard.
Or you could be like me and not really care what your lawn looks like, but
right,
that's not everybody I know.
Kim Lawn, who knows what's in that stuff?
Let's take a call. This is Susan in Henniker. Hi, Susan. Thanks for calling the Exchange. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thank you.
Sure.
I used to feed the birds in the wintertime, but now we go away for 6 months. Is it smart to start in the fall when you can bring the feeders back out and then stop and go away around the 1st of November? Or is it harmful to the birds to get used to you feeding them and then you're not there anymore?
Susan, I am so glad you called because a lot of people have this question about bird feeders. Go ahead, Pam.
Okay, two answers to that question. One is Fish and Game and Audubon Seconds This recommends that you do not put feeders out before December 1st and take them down by April 1st because there are lots of things that are way bigger and blacker and furrier than birds that will take them down and become problems called bears. And we really shouldn't be feeding birds during the bear season because, you know, causes problems for bears and so forth. The other answer to the question is that there is so far very little data, if any, that indicates birds depend on our feeders. So if you're going to put a feeder up in the winter and then go away on vacation for 2 weeks, then the birds will be fine. They will find natural food. They've been feeding on things out here in New Hampshire long before we started putting up feeders. So that would not be anything you need to be worried about.
So here's a question for you, Pam. I have a friend who keeps her feeders up all year long. She says, hey, I keep hearing about, you know, the crash of bird populations, you know, and that their food supplies may be all messed up because of climate change. And I want to help however I can. She also last year did have a bear sitting on her front porch. So there's that. But, you know, what about that? I mean, people hear, you know, you and Matt talking about these poor struggling birds and they think, I want to do what I can. I'm leaving the feeder up.
Yeah, most of the birds that are eating seeds are not the ones that are declining as much, for starters. You know, they're not the insectivorous birds. Bird feeders ultimately are things that we appreciate more than the birds need. And there's obviously nothing at all wrong with that. And if it helps us enjoy the birds, that's great. The birds themselves are going to need slightly different strategies to benefit from things that we do.
Oh, that's interesting. So just to make sure I have this right, Pam, the birds that are struggling are the insectivores. They're not going to say, gee, there's fewer mosquitoes this year, I'll eat seeds instead.
Right. And most of the, even most of the seed-eating birds feed their young insects. So during the summer, you know, bird feeders get a little quieter in general because there's, you know, a lot fewer birds out there looking for quick, fast food.
Oh, that's interesting. Except for the squirrels who, you know,
right.
And the love bears. The bird feeders. Okay. That is really interesting. I'm glad you called, Susan. Here's an email from Caroline that I'm going to throw to you, Matt, please. Caroline says, I love birds and bird watching. I have suet and seed feeders, and we have a great variety in our area. I do not want to harm the birds, Caroline says, and the pollinators in our yard. However, we do have ticks, and I'm wondering if you can make a recommendation for how to keep ticks at bay, but not put down harmful chemicals that hurt the pollinators and the birds. Caroline, this is a great question. Matt, what's your advice?
Well, if I had a good answer to that question, I could be retired right now, because I think that's one that so many people are dealing with. It's ticks are a challenge. I don't have a great answer to that question. I think that one of the ways that we can limit ticks is, at least around the areas that we frequent, is to keep some of the vegetation short. You know, ticks tend to be, at least in my experience, most abundant in tall grasses and in shrubs, and that's fantastic bird habitat. But in those areas in our backyard, although we certainly don't want the entire area like mowed flat, because that does reduce habitat for birds and other wildlife, in those areas where we are frequenting, you know, we're going out and enjoying the backyard, and as we said earlier, playing badminton and doing outdoor things, is to keep that vegetation short, just to inhibit the attractiveness of those areas to support an abundance of ticks. And outside of those areas, try to keep the areas kind of as wild as possible. But unfortunately, I'm not aware of too many birds that are actually eating ticks, at least enough to have any sort of control over them. So that's a great question. I throw that back to Pam, and maybe she has some better suggestions.
Well, and just to the yard, though, before we go to Pam on this, just paint a picture for us, Matt, an audio picture. Here we are on the radio. Sure. Of just sort of the ideal backyard where there is space for people to have, you know, cookouts or play badminton or whatever. But there's also sort of adequate spaces for birds and insects and so forth. Like, what does that look like ideally?
Yeah, sure. So I guess we're thinking when you look outside and you're looking and thinking about habitat, you know, I like to tell folks that, you know, vegetation occurs in different layers. So there's the stuff that's on the ground, that's the fallen logs and the leaves and, you know, the leaf litter. And of course, we're not going to have fallen logs and sticks on our lawn, but we can have those outside of our lawn and maybe on the backs of our properties or on our property edges. So it's lots of stuff on the ground that provides great cover. That's can provide cover for ground nesting birds, but it can also provide an abundance of insects, which many of our songbirds are eating at the ground level. Above that is kind of the herb layer and the shrub cover. So the stuff that's like the herbaceous cover and the woody plants from 2 to 15 feet tall. So a dense shrub layer. Again, that's not something that we would have in our lawn, but outside of our lawn and around the edges of our property, and particularly where multiple properties come together, you know, allowing that shrub layer to grow up is great to provide not only visual screening and privacy for us from our neighbors, but also to provide some cover for birds to avoid predators, shrubs that they can forage for berries and insects on, and even make their nests. And then, of course, the tree layer. New Hampshire is full of trees, and that tree layer is especially important. And so each of those layers has different birds that are associated with them. And so what we're trying to do from a habitat standpoint to encourage the greatest variety of birds is to have a variety of those different layers. And if you have a large property, you might be able to provide all of those layers on your land. But even if you have a small property, one of the best ways to enhance habitat in your neighborhood is to maybe try to provide one or more of those layers that don't occur on other on your neighbor's lands, or provide different plant species that don't occur on your neighbor's lands. And so, you know, birds don't birds don't look at a tax map. They don't recognize our property boundaries. And so the way, so the best way to provide habitat for critters is to manage in your land in a way that complements what your neighbors are doing to provide the greatest benefit possible in the neighborhood.
So it's almost like, Matt, have those neat, closely clipped spaces, you know, if you have kids or you want to do stuff in your back or front yard, but also have sort of messy spaces. And that's where the pollinators and the birds are going to hang out and be happy.
That's great. You know, the messier the better as far as the wildlife are concerned. And so it really just comes down to, you know, that works for me. You know, my backyard, I don't mow it. And it's, you know, some folks would come and they would say it would be a mess and it would be totally, you know, not something that a lot of folks would like to have in your backyard. You don't have to have that, you know, but, you know, decide what allows you to enjoy your backyard and then allow the rest of it to be a little bit wilder if possible. So yeah, you know, you don't need to have 5 acres to play badminton and to toss a ball and to have a cookout. So minimize that area of mowed lawn. It doesn't mean you need to completely eliminate it, but try to make it as only the size that you need, and then maybe allow some of the other areas to grow up a little bit to get some wildflowers or maybe some shrubs in there.
Well, we have to take a very short break, but when we come back, I want to ask about other threats to the birds that this report highlights, including artificial light and birds crashing into windows. Pam, I will ask you about that. And we'll take a lot more of your calls and emails, so keep them coming in. Our number is 800-892-6477. Use Facebook if you'd like, or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, how are the birds doing? New Hampshire Audubon's recent State of the Birds report outlines the health of bird populations, the threats they face, and steps large and small that Granite Staters can take to bolster both bird health and, by extension, the health of the planet. Listeners, we'd love to hear your questions and comments. How have you tried to help your own local birds? What questions do you have? Email us, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or call 800-892-6477. We're talking with Pam Hunt. She's an avian conservation biologist with New Hampshire Audubon. Also Matt Tarr, an extension professor and wildlife specialist at UNH Cooperative Extension. And both of you, right back to our listeners. George is calling from Wolfboro. Hi, George. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Well, thank you. Two house wrens have been putting sticks into a bird box that we have in our backyard. And now I'm looking out the window, and there are two swallows that have taken over. They're bigger than the house wrens. Right now, a swallow is half in and half out of the bird box. It was a bluebird box, but I enlarged the hole, which was, I'm afraid, a mistake. But anyway, should I step out and tell the swallows to go away so the little wrens can continue their good work?
Wow.
Probably there's nothing I could do, but I just wondered what the experts wanted to say about the relationship of house wrens and swallows.
No, I love the story, George. Thank you for calling. And we've gotten stories like this before on other bird shows about, you know, competition between birds for sort of prize spaces. What do you think, Pam?
Yeah, the short answer is wrens and swallows have been competing for nest holes since before human beings were probably in New Hampshire.
Wow.
And we'll continue to do so. So, you know, picking a favorite isn't really probably appropriate, and they'll sort it out.
So should he maybe build another bird box,
when in doubt,
as he put
yeah.
it? Yeah, I thought that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, people usually, tree swallows can be very aggressive. So can house wrens, actually. House wrens will peck holes on the bird's eggs. So neither of them is like an angel here. Putting multiple boxes up that aren't too close together will allow both of them to probably, you know, do what they need to do.
Oh, that's interesting. So birds will take advantage of those spaces if you build them.
Yep. If you build it, they will come.
Yeah, right. And what about artificial light, Pam? I was just reading this morning about how, you know, keeping the lights on all night long in our cities and towns can really mess with birds' reproductive cycles. So what's going on there?
Yeah, I'm not as totally up on the reproductive cycle thing, but I will point out something about light and migration, because most of our songbirds migrate at night because of various reasons. And when they go over extremely lit areas, you know, people talk about light pollution, especially astronomers, and large lit cities, Boston, Philadelphia, any of these big cities, I'm not sure whether Manchester makes the cut, but, you know, they'll see those lights and it'll, you know, interferes with their ability to, you know, navigate by looking at the stars because they can't see the stars, or they get distracted by those lights and just come in and, you know, fly around the buildings and get exhausted. Sometimes they fly into the windows and things like that. So lights at night can be a problem for migration. As far as reproductive cycles, I can only guess that it probably messes up their circadian rhythms so that they're, you know, they think the days are longer than they are, but I'm not terribly up on that particular.
Wow. So lights at night mess up their migration. And I had no idea, Pam, that birds migrated at night, because you don't usually hear them at night. So what do I know?
You can,
I just,
though, if
I
you,
didn't, yeah.
If you listen very carefully at night, like after 9 o'clock or so in the fall, especially, you will hear little tiny chip notes flying over your house, sometimes by the hundreds. It's pretty cool.
That's interesting. So what is New Hampshire Audubon doing to encourage cities to go dark? I mean, I know some people feel like, you know, for safety reasons, they want to keep the lights on. So what's sort of the policy there?
Yeah, we haven't done much with this, but there's a nationwide program called Lights Out, which I think Boston actually is participating in, where, you know, municipalities are encouraging, you know, cities, encouraging building owners or occupants of these big buildings to not leave their lights on at night, because, you know, no one's in those buildings. And this also saves a lot of energy. So it's one of those, you know, double whammy, everybody benefits types of things, you know, especially for high tall skyscrapers that are most likely to be distracting to birds.
Yeah. Well, and before the break, Matt, we were talking about, you know, people with reasonably sized yards, you know, some kind of yard, and how people can look at those outdoor spaces with an eye toward helping birds. What about people, Matt, with very small outdoor spaces, you know, maybe just a deck on the apartment? I mean, is there anything that those folks can do to help the birds?
Sure. You can benefit birds regardless of what scale that you have to work with. You know, so if you really are just have a deck, you know, maybe installing a nest box might be a great opportunity to actually enhance a nesting opportunity for a species. We can, even very small plantings can enhance pollinators, which may, in the large scale, may not necessarily have a significant impact to birds, but they certainly can help. But again, remembering that regardless of how big your property is, it's part of the larger landscape and it's part of your larger neighborhood. And so anything, especially as the size of your property gets smaller and smaller, being aware of what's available around you for different trees and shrubs. And if you decide that you're going to invest some time and effort into doing something on your land, try to do something that's a little bit unique, that again, complements something that's out there. Again, if you're surrounded by a big apple orchard, you know, adding one little apple tree in your yard probably doesn't do that much to enhance the habitat. So choose something that's a little bit different to add to that diversity.
You know, it's interesting, because sort of going from the backyard level, Matt, to the city and town level, what are the considerations for developers, be they private developers or cities and towns, as they build housing, as they build infrastructure and so forth? Like, what would you like them to do more of to enhance bird habitat at the community level?
Well, that's a great question. Again, that's the landscape that's probably the most challenging. But again, I think we're seeing that even in some of our more developed landscapes, there's often a lot of areas that are available for open space. And so again, you know, making good landscaping decisions where, you know, trying to have those areas as vegetated as possible. They can be designed, again, following the guidance of a landscape architect and a wildlife biologist. You know, those areas can be designed so they're very aesthetically pleasing. They're great spots for people to get out, you know, at their lunchtime or before work to enjoy the outdoors. But that provide, you know, areas of dense cover and also provide a variety of different plant species that again can flower and can be in different times of the year and in different colors, so they're very nice to look at, but also so they can attract a variety of different insects and then as a result provide feeding and cover opportunities for the birds that would be likely to be in those areas.
You know, I always think about this, Matt, whenever I go to like a mall or a big, you know, big store like Target or grocery store or something in the summer, it's really, really hot. I want to park under a tree so my car isn't a sauna when I get back from doing my errands. Why are there so few trees and bushes in parking lots? It seems like that's sort of part of the, you know, the urban landscape where it wouldn't be too much of a stretch for them to plant trees or shrubs to help the birds and also keep our cars a little cooler. Why is it all just sort of a concrete jungle there?
Well, I agree with you. I see the same sorts of things, Laura, and I guess I could only speculate about why they're designed that way. Probably that's just overall the ease for maintenance. But yeah, you know, so many of these big parking lots are just provide very limited habitat for so many different wildlife species. And those big parking lots probably are some of the most fragmenting features in our environment. You know, many, many birds are unlikely to cross those big wide open areas to try to piece together different patches of habitat. So that's a great example. I don't know a great way to do that, but it would seem to me that there's a lot of opportunities to perhaps break up some of those areas so they aren't quite so big and maybe have some islands, you know, that provide some cover in there. But really, you know, islands themselves might also be traps as well. So maybe providing the edges of those openings a little, you know, more diversity and cover around the edges, you know, to provide some habitat options for some wildlife.
Yeah, it's especially stark now because some of these malls are kind of dying. And so these, you have these huge parking lots, it's just concrete. Nobody's parked there because people aren't shopping at the mall anymore. And there you go. Let's go back to our listeners. And here's an email from Colleen. I have a robin who is aggressively defending his territory from the robin he sees reflected in my picture window. He keeps hurting himself in the glass. Whenever I hear it happening, I scare him away, but he keeps coming back. Is there anything else I can do? And a similar email from Nancy, who says, I have a south-facing picture window. To keep birds from hitting it, I found the special bird decals really help on the outside. And also for a few years, I placed netting on the outside of the window, taped around the edges, and that worked too. It is not noticeable to people once it's in place and can be bought at any gardening hardware store. Both of you, Pam, you first. Windows apparently are a problem for some birds. I think your report, Pam, says that, you know, a lot of birds crash into windows and die.
Yep. So yeah, to follow up on when I was talking about the lights at night, birds, you know, don't know what glass is, right? They either see like Colleen's example, they will see a reflection of themselves and think it's an intruder. I've heard stories of birds attacking themselves in cars' rearview side mirrors. Or they'll see it on a window and do the same thing there. They also either see the natural world around them, the trees in your yard reflected in the window, or in some cases they will see interior plants, like in a big lobby of a bank or something has plants on the inside, they'll see those. And so they don't see the glass. They will just, you know, try to fly into the trees or into the potted plant or attack their terrible rival there, and they will fly into the windows, which actually can be fatal. And in fact, collisions with buildings kills an estimated 500 million birds a year in the U.S. It's like second only to cats as a direct cause of mortality outside of a habitat. And as Nancy had pointed out, there's all sorts of things you can do to minimize the risk of birds colliding with your windows. The key thing is to have something on the outside of the window, because that way it breaks up the reflection. Your standard screen is perfect in that regard, or netting, as she mentioned, or something else non-reflective on the outside, like the decals. The trick with the decals is that just one or two aren't going to solve the problem, because birds will see the rest of it is still transparent, but not that part. There's all sorts of things you can do, like spacing kind of the special tape at like 4 inches across, vertical strips that'll break up the window. There's actually special glass that people make with UV etchings in it, because birds can see ultraviolet light and we can't. And the window is perfectly clear to us, but the birds see it and won't go into it. It's more expensive, of course.
Yeah.
But that's another option.
That sounds like a better option than putting tape and decals all over your window. I mean, you want to look out your window.
Well, that's why, you know, we look at our screens and we don't seem to mind those.
Yeah.
And the tape can be, you know, as Nancy had said, if you do something that's on the window, you know, there's lots of things to do. You can, you know, if you go to the Audubon's website where our State of the Birds report is, there's links to resources about windows. Some very elegant things you can do that also don't look as tacky as putting tape on your windows.
Yeah. So just a regular old screen.
Like that.
Just like a regular old screen is fine. Okay. Yeah. All right. Thank you for the question. And of course, as always, we have links on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. So you'll find the Audubon report there that Pam mentioned. There is a lot of very useful information about, you know, plantings in your yards and windows and so forth. So again, it's nhpr.org/exchange. We're going to take another very quick break. And when we come back, we'll ask our guests what we can learn from avian success stories. Because as Pam pointed out earlier, there are some bird populations that are doing well. So what can we draw from that and perhaps apply to the rest of the birds? All that's coming up. Plus, keep your emails and calls coming in. It's great to hear from you. Our phone number is 800-892-6477. And our email is exchange@nhpr.org. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, a New Hampshire economic update, the outlook for summer tourism, jobs, and housing. Join us for that conversation tomorrow morning, live at 9. Today, we're looking at the latest Audubon report on the health of our bird populations here in New Hampshire. And we've been hearing from you. What have you observed about birds in our state? How are you trying to help them out? Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Comment on Facebook or call 800-892-6477. We're talking with Pam Hunt with New Hampshire Audubon, also Matt Tarr. He's with UNH Cooperative Extension. And both of you, right back to our listeners. And Ian's calling from Chichester. Hi, Ian. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah. Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to make the point that when we think about birds and the health of birds, we have to think beyond our borders to a certain extent in their southern habitat. You know, like when we go, as consumers, we go to the grocery store and we buy coffee. We want to make sure we're buying bird-friendly coffee and make sure it's really bird-friendly coffee. And then even beyond that, you know, when you buy even organic sugar that's from Brazil, you know, they're cutting down lots of rainforests to grow organic sugar in Brazil. Now, it's great to be green and get organic sugar, but you have to think about the bigger picture on all those things, because the southern habitat is very important to those birds as well, because they're getting their energy to, you know, fly back up here and bring enjoyment to us. So I just wanted to make that point and say thank you very much for the show.
Oh, well, Ian, I'm really glad you called. This is a really important point. We haven't covered it yet. So go ahead, Pam.
Yes, Ian, you're my hero of the day. I pound that nail in every time I can, because most of our migratory birds spend over half their lives not in New Hampshire. So, you know, what I used to say, people, the line is what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. Well, what happens in Brazil doesn't stay in Brazil. And it affects our birds' survival in the winter or their ability to migrate north and all these things. So considering what happens when the bird leaves New Hampshire in the fall is absolutely critical to conservation of birds.
You know, I've heard the advice, Pam, about bird-friendly coffee. But Ian mentioned other products like organic sugar from Brazil. Are there other sort of quick hits you can do when shopping for your groceries that are supportive of birds besides the obvious bird-friendly coffee?
Yeah, coffee's the easiest one. What I always say and what we say in the report is when you can, eat local.
Okay.
Because that, you know, eat local, eat organic. You know, I sometimes people talk about, you know, going vegetarian. There's a climate change impact for that. But at the same time, we still need, you know, large areas of outside the U.S. are being cleared for agriculture, whether it's for soybeans or rice or shrimp farms. And all of that filters up to migratory birds at some point. So the best solution, and it's not a perfect solution because we can't do it perfectly anymore, is to, you know, try to eat locally and organically as much as possible and just be aware of how your purchasing decisions affect this bigger migratory pathway thing.
All right.
Well,
Ian,
know.
Yeah. It's great to hear from you, Ian. And let's take another caller. This is Kevin in Concord. Kevin, welcome to the Exchange. You're on the air.
Hi. I have an interesting story. I've had several that have happened down on my porch, and I have an enclosed porch now, and I'm on the third floor, and it's about 16 feet wide. And 2 years ago, I had these birds that came to my porch and built a nest on the right side near my door. They were gray, and they had the male had an orange breast. And then they just vacated the nest. And shortly thereafter, another nest appeared in the middle of the porch, and it looked like the same couple. And I said, oh, they're back. But what it turned out was there was two couples of the same species, because the original couple came back, and they used to fight with the second couple. And I have a tree outside my porch. It's very sparsely leaved, so you could see everything that happened. And the females would be pecking each other and the males. And I guess the second couple had their babies, but the first couple came in and kicked them out and were raising the babies for most of the summer. And they occasionally go out in the tree and fight with each other. And then towards the end of the summer, the original couple came back and repossessed the nest. And they actually built an adjunct nest on the left. I don't know if that was for the mother or for the father or for when the babies got bigger. And it was just one of the most interesting things I've ever seen. And I could tell the difference because the second couple was a little bit smaller and the male had an orange breast. And the first couple was a little bigger and the male had sort of an orange-red breast. But I've never seen anything like that. And at the
wow.
end of the summer, yeah, really. And at the end of the summer, I just saw this little flutter of wings, and I said, that's it. They flew the nest. But it was uncanny. I'd never seen that before. And I had the opportunity to observe all this because I wasn't working at the time. So very interesting.
What a cool story, Kevin. And Pam, what a soap opera. That's like, you know, a made-for-TV movie or something. I mean, what does that sort of say to you about bird habits and habitat? I mean, there they were on, you know, Kevin's third-floor porch.
Yeah, my guess is that they were probably robins or maybe house finches, both of which have reddish or orange breasts. I don't know how big they were. And there must have been some prime real estate, like Matt was saying earlier. You know, even on the third floor porch, there might be a place for some of these birds that are very, very happy, you know, living where people are to do their thing. And apparently it's prime real estate.
I want to ask both of you, and Pam, you first, please. You know, both you and Matt talked about, you know, the big, big threats that birds face. But the recent Audubon report does highlight some birds that are doing really well. I myself see raptors in my, you know, my downtown Concord neighborhood all the time. So who's doing well, Pam?
Yeah, so the two really big success stories in the last 50 years have been birds of prey, as you mentioned, and waterfowl, ducks and geese. And those are both largely because we identified the threats early on and put a ton of resources in the case of waterfowl, back close to 100 years, and conserving habitat, or in the case of raptors, doing things like banning DDT, which has allowed eagles, you know, eagles are all over the place right now. 30, 40 years ago, there were almost no eagles in New Hampshire. Now there's like almost 80 pairs.
Wow. So what is it, Pam? I mean, how do you apply those success stories for those particular species to the sort of wider threats that birds face?
Yeah, and if we could figure that out, we'd be in great shape. And it's tricky because in many cases, the things we've quote unquote solved were also somewhat simpler problems. Those species don't migrate as far, so we didn't have to worry about what was happening in Central America or the Caribbean. Those species are large. They're a lot easier to like rear in captivity. We did that with eagles and peregrine falcons to release them. When you throw in this long distance migration, it gets very tricky. And the fact that we haven't fully identified the threats, is part of the problem.
Or that the threats are so sort of multifactorial, right, Pam? I mean,
right.
You know, climate change and the decline
climate
of the insect population.
Yeah, fix climate yeah. change will be perfect.
Right. Matt, what are your observations here about just particular strategies from these bird success stories that might be applied to the many birds that are struggling?
Yeah, sure. So, the Pam's report, one of the really, I think, valuable things that, you know, she does in there, she really breaks it up on a habitat basis. So, you know, birds don't occur across our landscape randomly. You know, most of these birds have particular habitat needs, you know, so some birds like lynx and meadowlarks, you know, they require large grassland habitats. Other birds like scarlet tanagers and black-throated green warblers, they require mature forest habitats. Other birds, like our eastern towhees and prairie warblers, they require young forest or shrubland habitats. And so what we find is that, you know, certain, you know, some of the birds that seem to be doing the worst are those birds that are in the grasslands and that are in the shrublands. And that's largely just the result of habitat loss. Those habitats have always been somewhat uncommon in New Hampshire, but today, largely as a result of development and just the way we manage our landscape, those habitats are becoming especially uncommon. And so the birds that require those habitats are especially uncommon. But we also find that those birds that require mature forest habitats, many of them are having difficulties as well, largely, again, as a result of habitat fragmentation due primarily to development. And so, you know, from a conservation standpoint, and this even comes down to the individual landowners, you know, what we do on our property makes a difference. And so what we always encourage folks to do is if they're interested in learning what they can do, it's really a site by site thing. And so please reach out to, you know, folks at New Hampshire Audubon, at folks at UNH Cooperative Extension. Be very happy to chat with you to help you figure out, you know, how does your property fit into the surrounding landscape? And are there, and do you have opportunities to enhance or create specific habitat types or habitat components that are going to be most beneficial to the birds in your area?
Well, and Matt, we've talked about this a little bit before, but I want to ask you again, you know, the report lists chemicals and pesticides also as major threats. Where do we see the most pesticide use? You know, is it people in their backyards? Is it New Hampshire farmers? Is it businesses who don't want to do a lot of landscaping work and so they just dump pesticides instead? Is it public parks? I mean, we've known for so long that pesticides are bad for, you know, insects and birds. So who's still using this stuff?
I would say all of the above in some level or another, you know, but perhaps some of the most, you know, I think agriculture gets pointed at ag quite a bit. But perhaps one of the most concerning things is the amount of chemicals that get used in people's backyards, largely by landowners and homeowners that are well-meaning, but, you know, just don't necessarily have the training to know how to, you know, whether those chemicals are actually needed and how to apply them appropriately. And so, you know, much of our landscape is, you know, suburban backyards or just other backyards. And there's a lot of chemicals that gets applied into those landscapes, largely because people just want their land to look a certain way, which I don't necessarily disagree with that. But, you know, that's certainly a challenge. So, you know, to Pam's point, you know, anything that we can do to reduce and ideally eliminate, you know, chemical use on really all of those properties over time is probably going to be the best for the greatest variety of wildlife diversity.
Well, speaking of wildlife diversity, here's an email from Ruth who says, I feel so lucky to live where I do. This morning, a friend and I walked less than a mile from my house and tallied 43 species of birds in about 2 hours. Oh, Ruth, that's great. And here's a funny email from Danielle. Danielle says, we feed the birds and take the bird feeders in every night during bear season. However, Danielle says, if we're late putting the bird feeders out in the morning, a female cardinal comes and knocks on our window. When it first happened, we didn't realize what was going on, but finally realized the bird feeders were not out every time she came knocking. She also knocks when there's too many blue jays at the bird feeder. She's pretty amazing and demanding. Wow, Danielle. Pam, it's yet another story from a listener about sort of amazing bird behavior. This bird sounds pretty smart.
Yeah, they're birds are bird brain is a misleading term for starters. But yeah, you know, birds at feeders, you know, they may not depend on them, but they say, hey, this is a good deal we've got going here. And yeah, my feeders are out, you know, bring them in at night and there's a big hook on the deck and I get up in the morning, I got the window and there's a bunch of birds sitting on the thing going, where the hell did the photo go?
Really? They're waiting for you.
Yeah.
To put the feeder out. Wow, that's amazing. Last question for you both, and Pam, you first, please. Now that you have all this information, and this report is huge, it has sort of the meta trends about climate change and birds, but also the very specific information about, you know, certain things you can plant to help. What do you at New Hampshire Audubon hope to do with this information?
Have everybody read it and act upon it. It's probably the long answer for that. It's like, you know, just hopefully, you know, get word out about especially these simple things we've been talking about today, whether it's windows or keeping cats indoors or what you plant or use on your yard. That if more and more people are aware of those things, that helps mitigate any of the bigger issues we're dealing with, like climate change or fragmentation that, you know, need to be operated on a larger scale.
Matt, how about you? Who do you hope pays attention to this information? How hopeful are you that it will make a difference?
Well, I think that there's a little bit in there for everybody. And I think that everybody has an opportunity to contribute to the conservation of our wildlife. And I just want to encourage folks to reach out to folks at Audubon and Cooperative Extension in New Hampshire Game, because we're here to help you out.
Okay. Well, again, the report and a lot more are on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. Pam, it was good to talk to you again. Thank you for being here.
You're very welcome. Same to you.
That's Pam Hunt. She's an avian conservation biologist with New Hampshire Audubon. Matt, thank you as well. We appreciate it.
You're welcome, Laura. Thank you.
That's Matt Tarr. He's an extension professor and wildlife specialist at UNH Cooperative Extension. Today's show was produced by Exchange producer Jane Vaughn. Thanks, everybody, for being with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.